Gregory, we are approaching the end of year four of this war. Do you think there is any likelihood of a sustainable ceasefire, let alone a peace agreement, before we get to the end of year five?
I would like to hope that yes, it is possible. But again, it will depend very much on the position of our Western allies. So we have a very clear vision of how this war can be ended. We understand that there are things that our allies, I mean, we're very thankful to our allies, I must say, to the European countries, to the United States of America, but there are things that can happen faster, like sanctions, like, you know, President Zelensky just yesterday said that, again, repeated that, for example, the officials of the Russian energy giant Rosatom are still not under sanctions. They live freely in Europe, they, their kids, their families. So, and there's an issue of the shadow fleet. And, you know, we have seen how the Americans are dealing with the shadow fleet in their proximity. So why not deploy the same approach to the Russian shadow fleet?
Yuri.
So there are things that can happen. And if they do, then we stand a real chance of achieving a ceasefire by the end of this year.
Yuri Shak, former advisor to the Ukrainian defense minister. Thanks for having thanks for being on The Times at One with me. That's it from me for today. Producer was Lizzie Highfield and Adam Heaton was the technical operator. And Jane has walked in and she's up next.
Digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Stephen, and good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio. In the next couple of hours, well, there's been an outbreak of measles in North London. We'll assess what that tells us about vaccination rates, and we'll ask, why aren't some parents bothering to vaccinate their children? Is intermittent fasting really any good at all for weight loss? President Obama says he believes in aliens, but he hasn't actually seen them. What is the evidence? We're going to talk to an expert on conspiracy theories. Actually, perhaps it's madder not to believe in aliens. And Robbie Million will host our literary salon. We are talking Barbara Pym this afternoon, relatively rarefied part of the programme a bit later. And Adam Shaw with us at about 10 to 4, talking about AI and how it might be able to help with our personal finances. Here's the news at 2 from Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer says the Cabinet Office is investigating a Labour think tank that paid for a dossier which smeared journalists from the Sunday Times. Labour Together commissioned a company called APCO to investigate Gabriel Pogrens and Harry York. APCO's report included false claims that their journalism may have been based on a Russian hack. The Sunday Times revealed that Labour Together failed to declare more than £700,000 in donations. The group was fined by the Electoral Commission. Another journalist, Paul Holden, was also investigated and says the probe had a clear effect.
This investigation and the way this material was used was designed to chill the coverage of the story. And it does seem to me like the work that Labour Together were doing behind the scenes in getting APCO, in tainting the story, tainting me and tainting my source material, which I must point out is impeccably sourced, really did chill the story, made sure that the public was largely kept unaware of these incredibly important issues.
Labour Together insists APCO went beyond its brief. APCO hasn't commented. Keir Starmer says he's looking to meet NATO's target of spending 3% of GDP on defence by the end of this decade. He's previously pledged to spend 2.5% on defence by April 2027. But speaking this morning, he said the UK needs to go faster. Children could be banned from using social media as soon as this year. Keir Starmer says his government will be taking swift action. That could happen when a consultation ends in the summer. But the former Conservative Schools Minister, Lord Nash, has told Times Radio it's a smokescreen.
This is really pure politics, and the consultation may get us somewhere and it may not. And consultations, although they say they want to do something quickly, the Prime Minister also wrote this morning on a blog that he'll take the time needed to get this right. This is pure politics. He only came up with this to try and avoid the defeat in the House of Lords and to avoid a defeat from their backbenchers.
The man accused of massacring Jewish people at Sydney's Bondi Beach in December has made his first appearance in court. 24-year-old Navid Akram, his head shaven, appeared by video from a high-security prison cell. He was largely expressionless, responding yeah and yep to questions. He's accused of launching the attack with his father, who was killed at the scene by police. New warnings for ice and snow have been issued by the Met Office for much of the UK. A yellow warning's in place for northern Scotland from 3 o'clock until tomorrow morning, with more of the country covered from 6 p.m. Large areas of England, Scotland, Northern Ireland are under separate alerts for ice at the moment, or very shortly. And for News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, very good afternoon. It's Jane Garvey this week on the afternoon programme here on Times Radio. Fee's off for half term, but she'll be back next Monday. Please do keep in touch, as I'm obviously incredibly lonely. It's 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp number. In the next couple of hours, we're going to discuss that measles outbreak in a part of North London. Aliens and President Obama, he says they definitely are real. He hasn't seen one yet. Perhaps you have. And isn't it actually madder to believe that we really could be alone in the universe? It just doesn't seem likely. We're talking about intermittent fasting, which, as it's turned out, doesn't appear to work if you want to lose weight. So why not have a couple of hobnobs while you listen? The sport with Vassos, England's Six Nations collapse at the weekend, and Team GB's Winter Olympic triumphs, with more to come as well. We're absolutely confident about that. Vassos with me at about 3:15. And be aware, Robbie Millen, who is the literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times, he'll guide us through the literary world in our Monday Literary Salon, which starts at around about 3:35 this afternoon. We're going to revisit a Barbara Pym classic this afternoon and also discuss a book called Love Junkie. It's about a middle-aged housewife who falls in love with a male porn star. And it was a bit of a hit when it first came out back in the 90s, but it's now being reassessed. Apparently Madonna wanted to film it, but then she got distracted and never got round to it. But Robbie's got a great deal to say about Love Junkie. And if you've seen the American cover of Love Junkie, you'll probably understand why. And Adam Shaw is with us at about 3:50. We always talk personal finance with Adam on a Monday. This week, he's talking about whether AI can really help with your finances. Could it actually assist you with budgeting? Could it get you bigger returns? Any questions for Adam? You can get involved in the usual way. It's janeandfee@times.radio or the WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. All the big politics stories of the day as well, including that potential government social media ban for the under-16s. We'll get round to all that at around about 3:05 this afternoon in the company of our political correspondent, Terry Stiassny. Simon asks in a worried tone, are you sure Fee hasn't been abducted by aliens? No, I'm not sure. And I think I'm wise not to be 100% confident of that. I'm very much in the Obama camp when it comes to aliens. A quick look at the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, an extract from Gisele Pellico's book, A Hymn to Life. And at around 3:30 tomorrow afternoon, you can hear her lawyer, Stefan Babineau. I recorded an interview with him a little earlier today, and he speaks very powerfully, actually, about his relationship with Gisele Pellico, how much he admires her, and also his feelings about what went on in the courtroom. And it's pretty powerful stuff, actually. He's a compelling speaker. You can hear from him tomorrow afternoon here on Times Radio. The second most read story is Andrew met model on China trip as aide sent photos to Jeffrey Epstein. David Stern, a confidant of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, was in email contact with the paedophile financier during what was a taxpayer-funded visit to China. And the most read piece on the Times website, something we will discuss in the next 10 minutes or so, expats renounce British citizenship as new passport rules loom. This is a change that will require dual nationals to hold a British passport. It's been criticised for putting them at a disadvantage compared with foreign citizens. And as I say, we're talking about that very soon. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription. And if you don't have one, why not treat yourself? Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. Let's talk measles. And more than 60 cases of measles in children have been reported in North London, as officials there really do battle to contain an outbreak. Now, it's thought to be exploiting low levels of the MMR vaccination in parts of London. The Department of Health is launching a new campaign to increase childhood immunisations. It says they save 5,000 lives a year and prevent 250,000 hospital visits. Helen Bedford is a professor of children's health at University College London. Helen, what do you know about this particular outbreak of measles? And is that figure of 60 cases really very worrying?
Yes, it is very worrying because there probably are more cases, but it takes a while for them to be confirmed. And the thing about measles is it spreads incredibly quickly, and that's because it's very, very infectious. It's considered to be the most infectious disease there is. So to keep it away, we need really high levels, 95% uptake of two doses of MMR vaccine. And in Enfield, which is the focus of this outbreak, current uptake of two doses of 5 years is 64%. That means two in five-year-olds in Enfield are not fully protected against measles.
Why that low level of take-up? What do you think?
Well, London always has always had lower uptake than the rest of the country, and this is particularly low, but there are lots of things that play into that. So we know that a lot of families have difficulty accessing services, and people may say, but we're in the UK, we've got free NHS, we've got free vaccines, and that's absolutely true. But if you're living in poverty and you have a number of children and you're thinking about how to spend your money that week, paying the bus fare to take your baby to be vaccinated may not be a priority for you. But we also know it's difficult for some parents actually making appointments with their GP. And then again, the issue about where you get your information from is really important. And since about 2015, there's been almost a 43% reduction in health visitors around the country. So these are the public health nurses that have those very, very important early contacts with families in the home who talk about things like immunisation, and they're simply not there. So where do you get your information from if you've got questions?
Yeah,
very difficult.
Very difficult. I take your point. And let me just bring in a listener, Kerry, who asks about whether it would be possible to offer the MMR as a separate vaccine, not as a combo. In my view, I think this is child neglect, but I do understand some of the sensitivities around the triple vaccine. Are we still suffering from the misguided gibberish put about by that man quite a few years ago now?
Sadly, I think we are, and there is no need to have separate vaccines. We know that the combination vaccine is very effective and has a good safety profile. And if you think about it practically, two doses of MMR, if you separate it all out, that's six separate injections. Who wants to give their child six separate injections when you can give them just two? There is no reason to do this. It would be a backward step. And it would mean that people might not have all three of the components, putting children at risk of mumps and pregnant women at risk of rubella.
I wonder whether you could answer this. Another listener says, what is this lady on about? I can make a GP appointment on the NHS app. Well, it might be easy for some people to navigate the NHS app, but I guess not everybody, Helen.
No, not everybody has access. And we know very well from some research published last year that some parents have real difficulties making vaccine appointments. You know, they'll be told, ring up on a Tuesday, the clinic's the next Thursday. You ring up on the Tuesday, all the appointments have gone, so you've got to delay it another week. These are very common stories. And just because Times readers are able to access the NHS easily, it doesn't mean that other people are. And lots of parents with young children have incredibly busy lives and can't be spending periods of time making appointments.
Tell me about what happens if a child gets measles. Indeed, how would I know, for example, that my, let's say, unvaccinated four-year-old was showing signs of it?
Well, measles, like a lot of infectious diseases, starts like a cold. So with a runny nose, sneezing, cough, red watery eyes. Children often get a very high temperature, and then after about 4 days of these symptoms, a rash develops, and the rash starts behind the ears, and it travels down the body, and it's a spotty rash. It's sometimes raised, and the spots can all come together in blotchy patches. And children can be really unwell with measles. It makes you feel very sick because you have a very high temperature.
I didn't know that the rash was so distinctive that it started behind the ears. That's a given, is it? That's the
yeah,
definitely.
It starts, Yeah. Starts on the face and heads down the body. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I did not know that. But then I didn't know it because I've never known a child to have measles because I don't know anybody who hasn't had their child vaccinated. And I guess we're back to that whole, and I hear what you're saying about Times readers. I do understand that. That kind of entitled bubble, if you like, of people who wouldn't dream of not vaccinating their children.
No, and to be fair, you know, vaccination is such a successful intervention, as you alluded to at the beginning, that most people, particularly younger people, have no experience at all of anything, you know, more serious than chickenpox, although we now do have chickenpox vaccine just being introduced. Mm. So you forget, and it's quite difficult actually communicating to people who have no experience of a really sick child what a really, you know, what it's like looking after a really sick child.
No, I absolutely understand that, and I've been very fortunate that I've never had to. But what are the potential solutions in the short term for this outbreak? I mean, presumably you can set up temporary clinics.
Yes, well, clearly vaccination is the answer. There's a vaccine there, it's safe and effective. And you can actually be immunised even if you've been exposed. If you're exposed within 3 days being in touch with measles, it's very effective. So vaccination is the answer, and I believe that they're doing catch-ups in schools. But of course, this week it's half term, so it's quite important to think about vaccination, check your child's vaccination status in the Red Book or ring the GP. And, you know, that is the answer, just to stop this outbreak in its steps and vaccinate.
Yeah, the Red Book, not everybody keeps it, I suppose, but you certainly should. The GP will have a record, will they? That's a given as well.
Yes, the GP should have a record of that, absolutely.
Right, and should schools reach out and frankly be proactive and ban a child who hasn't been vaccinated, even though it won't be the fault of the child?
Well, personally, I think that's quite a difficult thing to do. But, you know, that we might have to think about that. What do you do if a child is infected and unvaccinated? Is it fair on the other children? But, you know, it's difficult in the short term to bring in things like that because you need very good records to do that. And schools don't always have access to that.
Kevin makes this point and asks this question. Is it really an issue of a low vaccine take-up by some ethnic minorities, and does Enfield have a high ethnic minority population? What do you say to that, Helen?
Well, we do see differences in uptake according to ethnic group, but it's not all. There are differences among ethnic groups. So some of the ethnic minority groups have incredibly high uptake and others poorer. So you can't just say it's down to that. But we do know that low vaccination goes hand in hand with poverty. So in more disadvantaged areas, you see low vaccine uptake, particularly in inner London. And of course, mobility, population mobility affects this as well. If people are families are moving around, they often are unable to get vaccinated on time.
Okay. Very briefly, can you still get it even if you've been vaccinated?
If you've had one dose, yes. If you've had two, yes, but very uncommonly. Two doses gives you virtually 100% protection, 98, 99%
right.
protection.
So, well, go on.
And just a last point, it's never too late to be vaccinated. So even if you're an adult and you haven't had the vaccine, you can be vaccinated.
Helen, thank you very much. Helen Bedford is Professor of Children's Health at University College London. And Janet makes this powerful point. My late grandmother in the 1930s buried two of her four children because of measles. That's what the illness can do. More education is needed to inform people of the complications that can result from such a dreadful disease. Thanks for all your messages and keep them coming. 0333 003 2353. Now, the Times reports today that expats are renouncing British citizenship before a rule change requiring all dual nationals to get a British passport. Lizzie Frenier is Associate Travel Editor for The Times and The Sunday Times. Now, these rule changes are getting some people very worked up indeed. What are they exactly?
So the rule change, previously, if you were a dual national, so if you had citizenship of two different countries, you could come into the UK on your passport for the other country. You didn't need to use your British passport to enter the country. But from February 25th, if you are a dual national, you must use a British passport to enter this country.
And only a British passport.
And only a British passport. So there's various expats who, you know, live around the world and have dual citizenship. And they've been coming for years back to the UK to visit relatives. And they've been using their Spanish passport or their Australian passport or whatever it is. And there's two things about this. One, this has come in quite quickly and perhaps hasn't been publicised enough. So people who've got trips booked in a short amount of time and have spent a lot on that trip are now panicked that they won't be able to get a passport
in
time.
Or it could be some sort of family emergency or something.
No, exactly. And the other thing is there's obviously a cost that comes with it. So applying for a new passport costs £94.50 for an adult. So then you've got to maintain two passports. And then and additionally to that, if you haven't had a British passport in a while, you might need to be resupplying documents that prove your citizenship. So stories of people that are that say, you know, they have no idea where their father's birth certificate is and it's become impossible. So they have the choice of either renouncing their citizenship so that they can then enter on their other passport, or, you know, going down this kind of admin rigmarole and paying money in order to get into the country. But it's interesting to me because I am a dual national.
Okay, I'm rather jealous, actually. It does sound incredibly glamorous. So tell me about your own family background.
So my mum's English, my dad's American. I was born in California, so I had an American passport, but my mum applied for me to have British citizenship when I was born, and I've had both passports my whole life. Luckily, I then ended up going to university in this country. I now live and work in this country, and you know, opens up so many doors to have both passports. And funnily enough, I, even before these rules, I've always, when I go to America, I use my American passport, and when I come to Britain, I use my British one, and I've kept both of them just because I've learned that is such a faff if you don't. You get so many questions about how long you're staying for, and, oh, you have a job in this country, but are you, you know, and even more so, my parents got divorced when I was, you know, 10 or 11, and my parents lived in different countries, so I used to fly as an unattended minor between the two countries. So you can imagine there's even more questions.
So you went on your own over the Atlantic?
Well, with my sister,
With your sister. Yeah, that's, a lot of people don't experience that, and I'm impressed that you did do it. And the questions would be, well, where are you going on your own, you and your sister?
And who's picking up from the airport? And they definitely your relation. We just learned it's better to have the clear passport. So it makes sense. Lots of other countries, like America, already had this rule that national, you need to come in on your passport from that country. So I, to be honest, I understand why the UK is doing this, and I think it's the right thing. But I think they could have, had the lead up to it, had a bit more of a grace period in order so that people weren't panicking, or if they're, you know, visiting for a health emergency, or they spend loads on flights, so they're not at risk at losing out on that now.
But it does make life a little more complicated than it is for people travelling here, for example, on a Polish passport. They'll just be able to come in.
Well, that's the thing that a lot of the expats are saying. You know, it's now more complicated for them to return to their home country than it is for someone that's just visiting for a holiday. And that doesn't really seem fair.
It isn't, I'm afraid. Just one of life's unfairnesses. Yeah. Good to talk to you, Lizzie. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Lizzie Frenier, who is Associate Travel Editor for The Times and The Sunday Times. Now next, Barack Obama says he believes in aliens, but he has personally not seen one yet. Does he, though? Let's just, if we had some spooky music, if there was a budget of any kind, we could play it now, but we haven't got any. Does he know more than he's letting on? It's 22 minutes past two. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wickes. The kitchen and bathroom sale's now on. Explore all the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or visit your local Wickes store.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation, telling the stories that matter, alongside a world-class lineup of guests, experts and contributors. There's a merry band of erudite intellectuals who join us every evening. Michael Binion.
We had a very interesting meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
Zoe Strimple.
There is real unease.
And Peter Hitchens, to name a few.
This is war, for goodness sake. Nobody tells the truth about what's going on.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
We travel to explore, to learn, to connect. At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Our itineraries are designed to help you explore and engage with your destination through its food, culture, and customs. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Right now, the kitchen and bathroom sale is on. There are options to suit every budget and every home. Browse all the kitchen and bathroom sale offers at wix.co.uk.
We're only how many days away? 3 days away from Proud as a Peacock Thursday. I'm looking forward to it already. This is where you can win £250 worth of Wix vouchers by just simply contacting us and telling us what's made you proud. We love hearing from you. Make sure you get in your entries before about 4:15 on Thursday. Time is very much on your side. Jan makes this interesting point about the measles outbreak. I think it's very worrying, she says, for parents of babies who aren't old enough to have the vaccine yet. They don't, of course, get the first one until they are 12 months old. Jan, thank you for that. And yes, I agree with you. We've just checked, actually, and you get offered the first of the MMRs at one, so 12 months, and then another as a top-up at 18 months. But you're right, it probably does mean that if you have a very young baby and you live in that part of North London right now, you're going to be pretty concerned, aren't you? It's Times Radio. It's 25 minutes past two. Now, Barack Obama has said he believes that aliens are real, but insists he didn't see any evidence of them when he was US president. He was speaking on a podcast over the weekend.
Are aliens real?
They're real, but I haven't seen them, and they're not being kept in,
Area 51.
Area 51. There's no underground facility, unless there's this enormous conspiracy, and they hid it from the President of the United States.
It's possible, isn't it? The comments quickly gained traction online, as they would. Peter Knight is a professor of American Studies at Manchester University, and he does specialise in conspiracy theories. Peter, take us, first of all, to Area 51, where it is and what is supposed to be going on there.
So Area 51 is in the Nevada desert, and lots of Americans for decades now have come to believe that the American government is keeping alien crash bodies and vehicles, and they've been keeping this secret from the American public. The reality, of course, is that Area 51 is one of the many sites where the US Air Force have been conducting secret military tests for years, and almost certainly that's what Americans have been seeing.
I see. So they've been seeing what peculiarly shaped aircraft of one sort or another?
Yes, lots of kind of test craft they're seeing, or in some cases it's just merely weather phenomenon, meteorological phenomena that they can't quite explain otherwise. But, you know, where alien or UFO sightings have been around even longer than people have been talking about Area 51, you know, the most famous one goes back to Roswell in 1947, where it was claimed first by the American Army that some flying discs had crashed. Very quickly, they changed their story to say, no, it was just weather balloons. And it was only decades later that the truth came out, which was that they had been conducting secret tests to see whether the Russians had been testing nuclear weapons. And so, you know, there's a long history of both justified public speculation about events and yes, a kind of history of government secrecy. And if you kind of think about the way some of those UFO stories emerged, particularly in the kind of 1970s and 1980s, it turns out, and I'm now going to sound like a conspiracy theorist myself, but it turns out that the American intelligence agencies might have had a hand in spreading some of those UFO conspiracy theories, precisely as a way of distracting attention from their kind of secret military hardware testing and as a way of delegitimizing any kind of investigations into what might have been going on in the area.
Oh, I see. Gosh, you really got me worried now. I don't know who to trust, if anybody. We're not that far off another American trip to the moon, are we? Or have they ever really? I mean, they didn't really go last time. I mean, we know all that's going to come out again, don't we, when they do take a trip to the moon, which is meant to be imminent-ish.
Yes, yes. So the conspiracy theories will come back again, the idea that Americans never landed on the moon. And once again, you know, on the one hand, we can look at these as just kind of bizarre, kind of fringe conspiracy theories. No one in their right minds would believe in them. But we need to recognize that, you know, people have good reasons for being suspicious of their government, particularly in the US. You know, would the American government lie to its people about the fact that they didn't land on the moon? Maybe, you know, it's personally, I think it's, you know, highly unlikely, not least because the Russians would have been all too happy to reveal that the Americans had never landed there. But we do know that the American government has repeatedly conducted all kinds of unsavory experiments on its own people, like the kind of brainwashing experiments called MKUltra, which they hid from the public for decades, or the Tuskegee's Institute Syphilis Studies, which was a kind of decades-long program of absolutely immoral research on African-Americans, testing whether the kind of true course of what the course of syphilis would be, even when there was the invention of penicillin.
And that, of course, that particular case has led to, well, I mean, there's a real level of distrust between certain communities in the States and the medical fraternity, isn't there?
Yes, and understandably so.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a minority in America, the question shouldn't be why, you know, do you have high levels, you know, why are you susceptible psychologically to high levels of distrust? Instead, the question should be, why is it that the medical establishment is so untrustworthy?
Well, quite. Stuart says, I remember a news story back in about 1992 about UFOs in Scotland, which I think did turn out to be the then top secret stealth bombers. Does that seem plausible, Peter?
Yes, highly plausible. There are US air bases in the UK, and so sometimes what people have been seeing will be that. I mean, we also need to recognise that, you know, stories of alien encounters have been around for decades, if not centuries, and every era seems to get the kind of alien that it deserves. So in the 1970s, for example, lots of alien sightings or alien encounters, they were described as these kind of Robert Redford, kind of tall, Nordic, handsome creatures. But in the 80s and 90s, lots of the reports turned quite sinister, of alien abduction narratives, invasive medical procedures, anal probes. And one of the things we should ask ourselves is why now do little grey aliens supposedly look like they do?
Mm. Very, yes, powerful stuff. Plenty to contemplate. Thank you very much indeed, Peter. Peter Knight from Manchester University. Keith says, have you got time to ask about the Rendlesham Forest incident? Do you know what? During the course of that conversation, I was trying to remember the name of the forest. We have run out of time for that one, but we'll return because something went on in that forest. I think we all know that. It's just after 2:30 and you're with Times Radio. All that kale juice may have been for nothing because research suggests that intermittent fasting is actually no better for you than a standard diet. Here are the headlines just after 2:30. Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Some breaking news, and ministers have abandoned their attempt to delay elections to 30 councils across the country after being warned by lawyers the move would be illegal. Labour had announced plans to cancel elections for more than 4.5 million people in 30 areas this year to free up capacity for an overhaul of English council structures. But in a surprise announcement, the Ministry of Housing says it's dropping the plan after receiving new legal advice. It's understood that legal advice was related to a challenge from Reform UK. Sir Keir Starmer says the Cabinet Office is investigating a Labour think tank that paid for a dossier which smeared journalists from the Sunday Times. Labour Together commissioned a company called APCO to investigate Gabriel Pogrand and Harry York. APCO's report included false claims that their journalism may have been based on a Russian hack. And parents are being urged to make sure their children are vaccinated against measles. A number of kids have been treated in hospital for measles following an outbreak in North London. There have been more than 60 suspected cases in Enfield. Helen Bedford, Professor of Children's Health at University College London, says 60 cases is something to be alarmed about.
Yes, it is very worrying because there probably are more cases, but it takes a while for them to be confirmed. And the thing about measles is it spreads incredibly quickly, and that's because it's very, very infectious. It's considered to be the most infectious disease there is. So to keep it away, we need really high levels, 95% uptake of two doses of MMR vaccine.
And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Summer is calling. Book early for your trip to Turkey and get the most out of your holiday. Visit goturkeyair.com now and discover unforgettable experiences. Plan your summer getaway to Turkey today.
The Philly cheese stack is back at McDonald's and it's still intensely cheesy. Imagine the cheesiest thing ever. Now cover it in cheese. Add two beef patties, cheddar cheese sauce, crispy onions and even more cheese. The Philly cheese stack. Did we mention it's cheesy? Available until the 16th of March 2026 from 11 a.m. Fees apply to delivery orders. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep. Where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters. On your doorstep. Based on 2025 Amazon packaging data across the UK and EU.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
It is 24 minutes to 3 o'clock. I'm speaking slowly because neither of the next two guests are here, so just bear with. Now, I mentioned Rendlesham Forest, assuming that lots of you would know what's supposed to have gone on there. But if you don't know, it's just worth telling you that Rendlesham Forest is in Suffolk and it's currently managed by Forestry England. Yes, I am reading this. But it's famously known as the site of the UK Roswell incident, which involved reported sightings of strange lights near a former USAF base. Visitors can now explore the area via dedicated UFO trails and enjoy its dark skies for stargazing. There we are. So that's Rendlesham Forest. Holly says, I always thought that people who believed in aliens were just crazy until I listened to testimonies of US naval pilots who saw flying objects that defied any human explanation. The US government confirmed that that testimony was authentic. Now, I am joined by John Pienaar, and I think, like me, you have a bit of an interest in space and what might be going on out there, don't you?
I do. I guess it's a kind of a 10-year-old schoolboy is interested.
Yeah, well, that's kind of my level.
Yeah, yeah. And when you really get into what is going on out there, it rapidly gets pretty baffling, doesn't it?
It does.
But it is exciting. Why do you ask?
Well, just because we were talking about conspiracy theories and UFOs in the light of what Obama sort of said.
Yes.
I mean, you've got to be a bit careful.
Yes, before you very carefully unsaid it.
It's a Monday and, you know, you've got to go with what's available.
Well, it's the oldest conspiracy theory in the book, isn't it?
Well, you know, it is.
Flying saucers in the Nevada desert. The president, is he in on the secret, or isn't he?
He says that he's not.
Yeah, he says it's not happening.
Well, he would, wouldn't he? Because it's a double or triple bluff.
That's what the president in the massive blockbuster movie Independence Day.
Oh yeah,
that's what the president in that one said, and he was wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Don't trust any of them.
No.
You can though have faith in John Pienaar, who's with us between 4 o'clock and seven. What have you got today?
Very kind. So today, with the news just breaking, the government has dropped the plan to delay elections in over 30 local authorities in May, and that. The Times reports has a lot to do with the fact that Reform UK were planning a legal challenge, and they clearly did not feel confident of their ground going by that. So we're talking about that developing.
It's a big story, isn't it?
It is a big story. It's been a really rolling round for a while, and now the government, it's another U-turn, and not a comfortable one, because they've been holding that ground, or trying to, for a good long time now.
Just when things seem to be a little quieter.
When did it ever seem like that? And we're also talking
briefly
about
this morning.
Did it? Before we woke up. And then social media, talking about the social media. A plan. Will they, won't they, ban social media for the under 16s? And meanwhile, there are other restrictions today, but I'm arguing through some of the pros and cons. And also the question of is the government about to announce a massive increase in defence spending? Because they're under pressure to do that from all sorts of quarters, but doing it, that's when it really gets tricky.
OK, thank you, John. John Pienaar standing by to entertain and inform you between 4 o'clock and seven here on Times Radio. Josh says, it always really makes me laugh that aliens seem to almost exclusively visit the US and only certain southern states. I mean, it's a good point, but it doesn't explain Rendlesham Forest, does it? But it is odd. I mean, Tom Whipple is here, the Times science writer and special correspondent. Have aliens visited, for example, Saudi Arabia? Do we know?
I don't think there's been many sightings. No. They correlate quite strongly with fashions and fads within countries, and they anti-correlate with the existence of camera phones.
Ah.
Since the arrival of camera phones, it turns out that the aliens just haven't come.
We've scared them off. Okay. Tom's really here to talk about the science of intermittent fasting, which it turns out is no better for weight loss than your actual bog standard diet. This is disappointing. And lots of people, it's worth saying, have made quite a bit of money out of intermittent fasting. So what do we now learn about it?
Well, this is I'll give you the study and then explain my sort of caveats and nuances to it. So the study's a really good one. It's from this group called the Cochrane Collaboration, that they collate the best status of evidence for interventions. And what they've done is they've gone through all of the randomised controlled trials. So proper trials where people are told to do one thing or another and then compared. And they've done all the ones they could find for intermittent fasting, so things like the 5-2 diet. And what they found is they haven't done much better. They haven't done any better than just giving people standard dietary advice. They actually haven't really done much better than people doing nothing at all. Part of this is, part of what this has found is what we've known for a long time, is that basically diets fail, which is why fat jabs have changed everything, because we don't have the willpower and you lose the weight, you put it back on. This was studies following them for 12 months. One of the nuances in this is these are people who are obese and they've been told, they've been given advice, they've gone to a doctor.
This is the people in the study.
Okay. And it might well be different for people who've decided off their own back to do it and actually follow it through, because it's so hard to tell whether people are actually following dietary advice or not.
Okay. Because you could say any old thing, couldn't you?
Yeah, we know from, there's quite good studies that show that what people write down and tell their doctor are very different from what actually happens.
Yeah, a little bit like the, how many units of alcohol do you?
The fascinating thing of that is if you add up what you can extrapolate from a population from what people tell their doctor they drink, and then you can extrapolate it to alcohol sales in the UK, and you find there's a mismatch by about a factor of two. So what we tell them must be about half what we actually do.
Well, it's not as funny as the how many sexual partners have you had, and men say 108 and women say 4.
Yes, it's mathematically impossible.
Yeah, no, it's unlikely. Okay. Do we need to explain what intermittent fasting is? I mean, I'm conscious not everybody's this obsessed by weight loss.
One of the problems with studies is it's lots of different things. It can be you don't eat between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. The most popular is the 5-2 diet, where for 5 days of the week you eat normally, and then for 2 days of the week you have a severely calorie-restricted diet. And this was the thing that was made really popular by Michael Mosley. And it's you know, fundamentally, if you eat less, you are going to lose weight. One of the claims for this is it did more, because experiments in rats showed that they lived a lot longer as well. And it seemed to be resetting your metabolism in some sort of way. And this study couldn't measure that. And unfortunately, we can't measure that either, because the lifespan of a human is sufficiently long that you can't keep people on a fad diet to work out long enough to work out whether they actually do live longer.
No. OK. It is interesting, isn't it, that the jabs have taken over this market, basically, and they have changed the picture forever. Are we still certain that none of those jabs have any kind of long term negative impact on the people using them?
I mean, that's the sort of question that a scientist could never, ever say no to.
No, because we don't know, do we? So it was a daft question.
But it's not that daft, because for some of them, for Ozempic, we call it Ozempic, actually, the fat version is Wegovy, which is a slightly different dose. But people for diabetes have been taking Ozempic for quite a long time now, for years before this became a obesity treatment. And there hasn't been major side effects. Now, there are annoying side effects, which is sufficiently annoying that a lot of people don't stick it. And we're going to begin to see whether better versions of the drugs that you don't inject, that maybe have a lower side effect.
The tablets are coming, aren't
they? Tablets are coming, yeah. And they're going to be a very, very big thing.
And, I mean, do we know what percentage of people, and forgive me if you don't know the answer to this, what percentage in Britain are getting it on the NHS, and what percentage are paying out for these drugs?
I think, but readers do correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's pretty low still on the NHS. Quite a few people, if they can afford them, multi-percentage of the population are buying them themselves. But we're going to see these come through. In this projection, they're going to be a bit like statins, I think. I don't find implausible. I mean, one of the most interesting things is if you tease into the data in the US, for the first time in 30 years, the US is getting thinner. It's still a very, very fat country, but we're going to start seeing all this stuff coming through. And we're going to see it in the stock prices of Greg's, Dunkin' Donuts and all these things as well.
OK, so, their stock price is going to go down because people are buying smaller sausage rolls or not buying them at all.
Not buying them at all. I mean, already Marks and Spencer's and other supermarkets are putting out, they don't call them this, but they're basically the fat jabs range. It's food for people who don't want to eat. It's going to be a fascinating societal change. And I'm broadly in favour. I think these could do great stuff, but it is a bit concerning because we're going to be on these for the rest of our lives if we start taking them for them to work. That seems plausible. And to think we're all going to be medicating ourselves because we eat too much. I mean, there's an element of Last Days of Rome to it.
It's a depressing... and this is big, big, big pharma, isn't it? I mean, they are so having the last laugh.
Yeah, look, I mean, Ozempic is... it's the Novo Nordisk Foundation, and that's the reason why Denmark's economy grew in 1 year. They're making... I sat next to the guy from the foundation, which owns it, and it is a marvellous foundation. He's like, we don't know how to spend our money anymore. We've got so much of it.
Can you just cope with a couple of questions? Natalie says, and I'm asking you because you're very good at questions. Natalie says, any chance you could ask about the new studies on microdosing these injections for use to help people with eating disorders, cutting down food noise for people with anorexia? I mean, Natalie, forgive me, I don't quite understand that question.
I haven't come across... So the idea... It is fascinating, actually. I have not come across these studies, so I cannot comment on them. But one of the big things about these injections is they do cut down food noise.
Yeah, define that, please. Is that me thinking vaguely at about 4:45, I cannot wait for my pasta salad?
Yeah, this sort of... People say that... I mean... There is this continual background hum in their brain of I'm hungry, it's this, and, you know, bring me those pies. And maybe counterintuitively, that could have an effect with anorexia. There appear to be psychological effects of these. Mm. Some of the really fascinating stuff is how they seem to treat other compulsions. Shopaholics, alcoholics, drug addiction. Now, all of this is stuff that's being studied and being studied seriously. We don't have definitive answers. Okay. So if anorexia is also, to an extent, a compulsion, then counterintuitively, there is a possibility. But, you know, don't take medical advice from me, and I haven't read those studies.
Natalie, though, thank you. That's an interesting point.
Really interesting question.
Thank you for making it. This is from Michael. I've lost 4 stone in 11 months on Mounjaro. Honestly, it's the best thing I've ever done. Paid for it myself. Been worth every penny. I'm more active. I sleep better. And I'm more positive. Well, that's a ringing endorsement. Michael's paying for it himself. Why can't he just carry on taking it?
I mean, I think he should. I think there is an overwhelming case that these could be a really, really important public health intervention. And the fact is that obesity leads to so many other diseases that if we've got a way of... And it's all very well people saying, oh, you should just eat well, but we now have 30, 40 years of data that we can't do that, that it's really hard, and that if you do have a diet, you might lose it, but it will just come back.
Yeah, we just can't be trusted, can we? And Phil makes this point, as to Jane saying Big Pharma having the last laugh, yes, but hopefully they will mean, these drugs, that we get healthier so there's less demand for diabetes medication, blood pressure meds, etc. That's true, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. I mean, Novo Nordisk made all their money on insulin originally, and they'll hopefully be doing themselves out of a source of income.
Tom Whipple, always good to have you on the programme. Thank you very much indeed. Tom is our science writer here at the Times and Sunday Times and Times Radio. Next, will the government be able to keep under-16s off social media? We'll talk tech with Chris Stokel-Walker. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Carol is a doctor. She was fit and healthy, so she couldn't possibly have a heart attack, could she? Turns out she could. Carol was driving home and started to experience chest pains. As they got worse, she recognised the symptoms. She pulled over and called 999. Carol was taken to A&E and transferred to the nearest cardiac unit for further assessment and treatment. Here, it was confirmed she'd had a heart attack. As a doctor, Carol knew what signs to look for and what treatment she might need, but her experience was still life-changing. But a healthy doctor who ended up being diagnosed with heart failure? It seems so unlikely. Unlikely, but not impossible. Carol survived her heart attack thanks to the help of scientific research, but still lives with heart failure. British Heart Foundation is funding research into gene therapies that could prevent, treat, and even reverse heart failure, helping more people like Carol. When you donate to British Heart Foundation, you're helping to fund life-saving research. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
A social media ban for the under-16s could be enforced as soon as this year under new powers announced by the Prime Minister. Ian Russell is the father of Molly Russell, who took her own life. She was just 14. And an inquest later found that negative online content had been a significant factor. Now, Ian talked to Callum MacDonald on Times Radio Breakfast today about the long-term strategies needed to tackle online harms.
It's things like an overarching duty of care, which is really important because the current act, there's gaps that allow harmful content to sort of still exist online. Overarching duty of candor, so that the platforms have to be transparent. If there's something unsafe in the way that they work, they have to report that to the authorities. And also a sort of well-being. Things like stopping infinite scroll, for example, so we spend less time hooked on a platform.
Ian Russell. And now we talk tech every single Monday at around this time, and we're always joined by tech journalist Chris Stokel-Walker. Chris, this is such a difficult area. Is there any way actually to stop or curtail so-called doom scrolling?
It's incredibly difficult, Jane. And yes, I think fascinating to hear from Ian Russell there talking about this. He has previously said actually that he's not necessarily in favour of a outright ban on social media because he thinks that that could cause its own issues. But in terms of tackling doom scrolling, certainly we have some regulators that are going to give it a good old try. The European Union recently ruled against TikTok and said that actually the idea of doom scrolling, which Keir Starmer mentioned today in his visit to a London school to announce these sorts of intentions of regulating tech in some way, had pointed out was a problem. But I think it's just incredibly difficult to do so, because when you do that, you end up in a cat and mouse game. So if not the traditional endless scroll that promotes us listlessly going through endless numbers of posts, there will be another format that social media companies will use, because they have so much data on us that they can find out whatever way they want the best way of keeping us on those apps.
So, I mean, am I right in thinking that curtailing doom scrolling would mean some kind of facility that simply stopped the phone from functioning after a certain length of time?
Yeah, there are a bunch of different options being put forward. Some of those are already favoured or in place in some way, shape or form by the apps themselves. So TikTok has parental control features. It tested several years ago a little nudge to users to actually show them, once they had been scrolling for a long time, a video created by one of about a handful of popular creators that basically had them talking to the camera, so talking directly to the user and saying, look, you've been on here for quite a while now, might it be worth you putting the phone down? Turned out that they didn't really maintain that because it didn't have all that much impact. But there are other options and other levers to pull. Keir Starmer loves talking about pulling levers, as do many of the politicians that we have at the minute. One of those is to implement a kind of Chinese-style curfew, which has also been put in place in China, particularly around online gaming, but also social media. So you can't access it after, say, 11 p.m. So there are these measures, but with all of these things, there are workarounds. So you could maybe change the time on your phone to say that actually it was a different time entirely. Your children are very, very inventive when it comes to this sort of stuff, as I imagine many listeners at Half Term are learning about right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the idea that you could restrict children's, because that's what they are, access to VPNs, but I'm not sure you could do that either, could you?
No, I mean, one of the ironies of this is that a VPN requires you to hand over data, if you're going to do this, to hand over some sort of identification. And one of the reasons why we use VPNs, beyond the kind of use that has become more common since the implementation last year of the Online Safety Act, is it's used in repressive regimes or censorious regimes to try and find a way to get your voice out or to access websites that you're not meant to. And so the idea, I think, of introducing some sort of check or balance that requires you to show identification in order to use a VPN would be a troubling development. And it was interesting hearing Keir Starmer talking this morning and actually maybe softening some of the rhetoric that had been put out by the government overnight, saying, actually, I'm a parent myself. I know the challenges that my teenage children have. I empathise with you on that, and we're going to take soundings off the basis of our consultation and then move on from there.
Yes, I must admit, he seems to be slightly rolling back on the idea of a social media ban for the under 16s, a total ban. I mean, what do you think? Because they've threatened this, I'm using threatened in speech marks. Don't they sort of have to do it now?
It would be, I think, a huge disappointment to many people, not necessarily in Russell, but because he has come out and said that actually he's not sure about that, but lots of other campaigners and parents have said they think that is something that needs to be done. So if we had been talking truthfully, Jane, around about 6 hours ago, I would have said yes, the government looks like it's going to be minded to implement some sort of ban. But then Keir Starmer said just before at his school session that actually we have to take in mind what will be the results of the consultation. We also have a country-wide experiment going on in Australia. 4.7 million children under the age of 16 are being removed from social media because of their ban. I think it's probably worthwhile actually, and I know people are really concerned about this, just pausing, seeing what happens, getting the actual data, rather than trying to govern this really consequential decision based on feelings and emotions.
Yeah, okay, but you do get the impression, and we're talking politics after the news at three, that the government just has to be seen to be doing something. And if Keir Starmer wants to make his mark, then a ban on social media for the under-16s would be one way of doing it before he goes elsewhere.
It would. It would be a big question to understand whether or not that would be a big mark in the positive side of the Labour government or a big mark in the negative side. I think we'd probably have to wait about 20 years or so to find out for the impact of social media bans on children.
Yeah, OK. Can we have a quick word about the Motion Picture Association, which has taken a stand after an AI-generated video showed a scrap between Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt.
Yeah, not the latest scene from one of their blockbuster movies, although it was absolutely astounding. I know that we're on the radio, so it's very, very easy for me to say so, but it is well worth watching because this is very eerie, lifelike representations of these two partaking in a little bit of a pitched battle in what looks like a movie set. Now, in reality, what that was an AI-generated video produced by Seedance, which is a model developed by ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, and it is effectively a quantum leap in the abilities to generate a really lifelike video, and has put the spooks under the MPA, which is the industry body that represents filmmakers in the United States, because it says, well, really, this is beyond the pale. This means that we don't actually need actors, we don't need sets, we don't need humans to be involved in this process if we can spin it up. So massively concerning. Of course, one of the challenges and the questions here is, well, how did it get quite so lifelike, and on what is this model trained? That is, of course, a big question that is underpinning a large part of this generative AI revolution.
Can I just put this point to you from a listener who says, and we're back to the social media ban, get AI bots to act as a cipher for age-related social media content and then send appropriate warnings or notifications to parents, reciprocal AI bot, and then you could produce daily, weekly and monthly reports, presumably on the content being consumed by your nippers. Do you think that could work?
Yeah, this is a really interesting demonstration of a kind of cutting-edge technology that we are seeing at the minute, which is agentic AI. One of the things that is kind of interesting in the tech news at the minute is the acquisition, effectively, of a developer of one of these AI tools called OpenClaw. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago. OpenAI has basically brought him into the company, and at the same time, we're seeing Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram and all those, bringing in a similar agentic AI tool. So actually, what that listener has said, bang on, we could actually use AI agents to effectively create a digital twin of your kid and then warn you what they've actually been seeing.
Right, OK, that's really interesting. Thank you very much, Chris. Chris Stokel-Walker, who is our resident tech expert, joins us every Monday at about 10 to 3 to try and make this baffling world, well, a little more easily digested by those of us who really remember the day we got a calculator. I mean, it's hard to believe, isn't it? Right, I do like this time in the afternoon where we can just sit back and listen to the incredible music as we build up to the difficult time of 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Jane Garvey on Times Radio. I'm here until 4 o'clock, whether you like it or not. John Pienaar takes over then. But still to come, we'll get the latest from the world of politics in the next hour and speak to one of the journalists targeted in the dossier by the campaign group Labour Together. We're also talking literature in the company of Robbie Millen, the literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. This week, we pay a visit to an old classic by Barbara Pym, and we celebrate a book called Love Junkie by Robert Plunkett. That's after 3:30, but let's get the news at 3. Here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Ministers have abandoned an attempt to delay elections to 30 councils across the country after being warned by lawyers it would be illegal. More details from Times Radio's Cara Bentley.
Labour had announced plans to cancel elections for more than 4.5 million people in 30 areas this year. They said it was necessary to free up capacity for an overhaul of some English council areas. But the Housing Department now says the idea has been dropped because of new legal advice. It's understood that advice is related to a challenge from Reform UK. Its leader, Nigel Farage, has said on social media, "We took this Labour government to court and won."
Sir Keir Starmer says the Cabinet Office is investigating a Labour think tank that paid for a dossier which smeared journalists from the Sunday Times. Labour Together commissioned a group called APCO to investigate Gabriel Pogrens and Harry York. APCO's report included false claims that their journalism may have been based on a Russian hack. Parents are being urged to make sure their children are vaccinated against measles. A number of kids have been treated in hospital for measles following an outbreak in North London. There have been more than 60 suspected cases in Enfield. Measles is extremely infectious and 95% of children need two doses of the MMR vaccine to stop it from spreading. In Enfield, the uptake is just 64%. Helen Bedford, Professor of Children's Health at University College London, says poverty may be partly to blame.
People may say, but we're in the UK, we've got free NHS, we've got free vaccines, and that's absolutely true. But if you're living in poverty and you have a number of children and you're thinking about how to spend your money that week, paying the bus fare to take your baby to be vaccinated may not be a priority for you.
The man accused of massacring Jewish people at Sydney's Bondi Beach in December has made his first appearance in court. 24-year-old Navid Akram, with his head shaven, appeared by video from a high-security prison cell. He was largely expressionless, responding yeah and yep to questions. He's accused of launching the attack with his father, who was killed at the scene by police. New warnings for ice and snow have been issued by the Met Office for much of the UK. A yellow warning is in place for northern Scotland from now until tomorrow morning, with more of the country covered from 6 p.m. Large areas of England, Scotland and Northern Ireland are under separate alerts for ice. And a researcher says the brain can retain some degree of consciousness for minutes or hours after a patient has been declared dead by doctors. Anna Fowler told a conference in Arizona the transition between life and death may be a gradual, interruptible process. She says that according to emerging evidence, biological and neural functions do not cease abruptly. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, kitchens and bathrooms.
Good afternoon, 4 minutes past three. In the next hour, we're talking personal finance with Adam Shaw at about 10 to four. This week, it's on the subject of AI and whether or not it can help you with your personal finances. So Adam on that a bit later. Robbie Millen talks books at about 3:35. And we're also celebrating the world of sport with Vassos Alexander very soon. Today, we're talking about Scotland's triumph over England in the Calcutta Cup in the Six Nations, the Winter Olympic glory, which I really enjoyed actually yesterday, and some news from Wimbledon as well. So Vassos with us very soon. But news breaking in the last hour, you did hear it here, the government is abandoning the plan to delay elections for 30 local councils across the country. Reform UK had launched legal action over the delay, and ministers have now been warned that the move would be illegal. Elsewhere, Keir Starmer says the government's looking into the conduct of Labour Together. This is the left-wing think tank which paid for a dossier smearing Sunday Times journalists. The PR firm APCO compiled that report, which falsely claimed that the paper's reporting was based on a Russian hack. Terry Stiasny is our political correspondent today. Terry, it started off relatively quiet today, but as ever, the pace has picked up, hasn't it?
Yeah, recess or no recess.
Yeah, it too right. So, I mean, there is no other way to interpret it, but the abandonment of the local council elections, which are now back on again, that's another U-turn.
It is another U-turn. If you look on the Housing and Local Government's website, on the 22nd of January, they were saying we are still going ahead with legislation to postpone elections for these councils, for 30 councils. That's going to affect more than 4.5 million people. And as of today, in the face of a High Court case, which was being brought by Reform, they have decided to withdraw the decision and decided to go ahead with the local elections as they had been previously planned.
OK, now remind me why they were ever cancelled in the first place.
They were cancelled because in a lot of these, they were borough, district and some county councils in places like Western East Sussex, Norfolk, Suffolk, for instance, and they are where the local government is being reorganised. And the government, and to be fair, some of the councils, had originally thought that this is too much to try and do, to be trying to reorganise your councils into unitary councils and then to be holding elections for, you know, the new body that's not really created yet. So the government said, well, look, we'll just put this off till next year. But they've been challenged.
Right. But the original problem still exists, but the elections will now go ahead.
The elections will now go ahead. The department said, following legal advice, the government's withdrawn its original decision to postpone 30 local elections in May. They say that providing certainty to the councils now is the most crucial thing. The government said it's going to have to change the legislation, revoke secondary legislation. It's written to the councils, it'll help them. And it's also promised them £63 million in new funding. So it's an expensive exercise.
A costly enterprise, as it's turned out.
And as we've seen, Nigel Farage's legal letter, in which he is, he's very happy to have this letter from the government. He said, we took the Labour government to court and won, and they'll also be paying his costs.
Right. So you have to say that's a triumph for Nigel Farage, isn't it?
Well, he's certainly, yeah. I mean, this was going to come to court on Thursday. Here we are on Monday, and the government's changed its decision.
OK. First U-turn of the week, and it's not even 3:30 on a Monday. Let's talk about the social media ban. I must admit, I was expecting something a little bit clearer out of all this today when the Prime Minister talked about it. But we now don't seem to have an imminent ban on social media access for the under-16s. I thought it was going to happen before the end of the year, but now I'm not so convinced.
No, the government's consultation is going on. It will go on for the next few months, and they are looking at whether there should be an outright social media ban for under-16s. But if you listen to what the Prime Minister was saying in public today when he's been meeting people and talking about it, he seems to say, look, there are still arguments on both sides, which is what his position has been up until now. He's saying, you know, yes, there is bad stuff, but there is also good stuff, for instance. And he was talking to some young people at a public event that he was doing, who were saying, well, I get my news through social media, for instance. Why would you want to stop me from doing that if you're going to let me vote when I'm 16?
Yes. But on the other hand, I mean, we're all haunted by images of young people in our lives endlessly gawping at their phones when really they could and should be doing something else. The government's got to do something about this at some point, surely.
Yes, I think they will do something at some point when this consultation is finished. One of the things that they want to crack down on more quickly that is not part of this consultation is things like AI chatbots, which get into very involved relationships with young people. They said that they could crack down on that, for instance, as they did when Grok on X started doing things involving images. They want to try and stop apps being set up to encourage you to doom scroll, to constantly be replaying things and sort of sucking you in more and more. So there are some things short of a full ban, which they might well do more quickly than that.
OK, and they really will have to do something quickly just to change the conversation, to make it look as though the government is indeed robust and proactive.
Well, yes, again, because, you know, if the consultation comes back and they say, well, you know, we've thought about this, but we're not going to do anything about it, then it starts to, yes, look like potentially another U-turn happening.
Stay with us, Terry, if you can. We're going to bring in Matt Taibbi. Now, he's one of the journalists who was researched about by the PR company APCO, because Labour Together had asked them to do that. It's not the best use of English I've ever employed, but let's go, or deployed. She says, battling for the right term, but let's carry on with it. Matt, hello, how are you? Where are you in the world?
I'm in New Jersey. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure. So tell us about this. You work for the Sunday Times, is that correct?
No, I don't. I have a site in the States called Racket on Substack. I worked for Rolling Stone for a long time.
Right.
But I'm in the middle of this mainly because I published some material by Paul Holden a few years ago. I also did some additional work of my own on Labour Together and its financial history here in the United States.
Okay, so excuse my confusion.
That's all right.
But it's interesting that Labour Together are obviously part of your story. What were you reporting on Labour Together for?
So I had done a story that was gained a lot of attention in the States called the Twitter Files that was largely about the suppression or censorship of political speech at various platforms like Twitter and Facebook. And I kept running into material involving something called the Center for Countering Digital Hate, which was tied to some folks in Labour. Because of that reporting, Paul Holden, who had been doing researched for quite some time. He's sort of British and South African. He ended up writing a book about Morgan McSweeney called Fraud and Labor Together. And he came to me with a book with a lot of material that included unpublished emails and some other things that suggested financial corruption and some other things. And we published that. And as a result of that coverage, this dovetailed with another report that had come out in the Sunday Times. We were all kind of lumped together by Labour Together, and they hired this company to look at us.
Okay, so the suggestion that reporting on Labour Together was coming from Russian sources, what do you make of that?
So, first of all, it's completely absurd. We can demonstrate exactly where that material came from. Most of it, oddly enough, came from Freedom of Information requests. But the important part is that the reason you're hearing that is because we now know, looking at the materials that were involved in the commissioning of this contract, that one of the tasks that APCO had was to come up with an agreed-upon narrative for countering the reporting of all these disparate journalists. You can imagine people like, you know, Gabriel Pogrin and myself and Paul Holden. None of us, at least I'm not, you know, a colleague of most of those folks, but we were all lumped together as essentially useful idiots for Russia in this report. And the language, as I understand it, is more extreme than just saying that we used materials for a Russian from a Russian hack. So that's why you're hearing that story when a lot of this stuff is just source-based reporting.
And what do you want to happen right now then?
Well, the most immediate thing that I think needs to happen is that the public needs to see that final APCO report, because from my understanding, according to my sources, is that the thing that people are most concerned about in both within the Labour Party and at APCO is that that final report get out. The Sunday Times has it. I reported that over at the end of last week. They did a story about it on Saturday, but they have not released the contents of that report. And I think people need to see it because all the other journalists who were roped in need to see how they were described and need to see what was passed on to the National Cybersecurity Center.
I mean, this is, or could be, or may well be, a deeply troubling attack on the work of the free press.
Oh, absolutely. It's outrageous. I mean, the one thing that makes it quasi-acceptable is that it was at least initiated before Keir Starmer came to power. The problem is that this report was apparently circulated among members of the cabinet afterward, and nobody said anything about it. Nobody objected. And that is a serious problem when members of the government are using private intelligence firms, or at least using their product. And then also there has been a lot of whispering to journalists about the contents of this report. And you will see that appearing in the news, uncredited and not attributed to any named sources, but it's out there and that's a problem.
Thank you, Matt. That's Matt Taibbi. He was one of the journalists researched for that PR firm APCO's report. Terry, what do you think of that?
Well, I think, there's a slightly different situation in the United States. Obviously, Matt Taibbi was there, was saying perhaps, you know, we should publish all of the information that was gathered on people. And I think, you know, probably many of the journalists named in that report would not necessarily want this information, much of it, you know, which is probably not true, to be put into the public domain, even if it's not, you know, in the interest of showing what was researched on them. I mean, the Cabinet Office is looking into this at the moment. We don't really know what the nature of that investigation is. Liz Kendall said earlier today they were looking into the facts of the issue. But one of the problems here is that one of the people they are looking into is a current junior minister in the Cabinet Office,
Josh Simons,
who worked for Labour Together before the election and is now a minister. So, you know, how do you investigate that when he is, you know, one of the people potentially concerned with this? Although Downing Street is saying, you know, journalists should be able to report without fear or favour today, you know, this is really potentially damaging that people who are now in government were getting a company to gather information on journalists. Now, they say the company concerned overstepped the mark and that wasn't what they were asked to do. But, you know, this is something that we still need to find out more about.
Yeah, it's a pretty unusual set of circumstances, isn't it? At least I hope it's unusual.
I think it's unusual. I mean, I think it's certainly, you know, rumours go around, gossip goes around, people spread stories about other people. But to sort of outsource to a PR company finding things out about people claiming things about people and then putting them down in writing is I hope it's unusual.
Yes, well, exactly, we can agree on that. A brief word on defence spending. The Prime Minister today has made some comments about defence spending. He says it does need to go up.
In a few days' time, it's the four-year anniversary of the start of the conflict in Ukraine. We want a just and lasting peace, but that will not extinguish the Russian threat. And we need to be alert to that, because that's going to affect every single person in this room, every single person in this country. So we need to step up. That means on defence spending, we need to go faster. We've obviously made commitments already in relation to that. But it goes beyond just how much you spend. It's also whether you coordinate and collaborate with other like-minded countries, particularly in Europe.
So defence spending, are we clear there that he is saying, yes, we are going to spend more money on defence?
I think he certainly wants to be able to do that. And certainly having just come back from the Munich Security Conference, where he's been talking to his other counterparts, particularly in Europe, talking about the wider threat and the rising costs of defence spending, there is this ambition to try and get to 3% of GDP now in this parliament. But of course, that has got costs of its own. I mean, that, you know, up to £17 billion a year to try and do that earlier, that money has got to come from somewhere else. You know, would that be overseas development? Would it be transport? All of those things are a trade-off that the government has to make.
Yeah, OK. I mean, today was sort of going to be another reset. I mean, we've had quite a few, but there is no doubt that the headlines are probably going to be dominated by the U-turn on the council elections. That's going to be today's takeaway, isn't it?
Yes, I think very much so. I mean, certainly because this is something that affects so many people, 4.5 million people who, you know, will now have local elections that they thought they weren't going to have to. It changes all sorts of political calculations, but it is something that actually matters to a lot of people.
Terry Stiassny, thank you very much. Terry is our political correspondent today. You're with Times Radio. It's 19 minutes past three. And next, Vassos Alexander is here with a Times exclusive on Wimbledon. And he'll tell us what England's defeat to Scotland means for their Six Nations campaign. And if you're listening in Scotland, he'll tell us what Scotland's triumph over England means for their Six Nations campaign. It's Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wickes. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or go to your local Wickes store.
Carol Walker on Times Radio.
The Prime Minister wants to increase defence spending faster than planned. We'll assess whether he'll be able to deliver more ambitious targets. We'll look ahead to more talks between the United States and Iran tomorrow. And should children under 16 be banned from social media? We'll discuss whether the latest proposals will work and how they could be enforced.
Carol Walker, tonight from 10 on Times Radio.
Discover the world of Dobble, back in McDonald's Happy Meal. Race through the worlds of music, sports, space and more. How quickly can your little one spot the match? Dobble's bursting with fun. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 5th of March 2026, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy. Dobble range comprises toys only, while stocks last.
And when teams feel supported, they can achieve anything.
Sorry, just had even more of my team are off ill.
Have you tried Benenden Health? It's easy to set up. They've got a GP helpline you can book 24/7.
Where were we?
A coffee break, hopefully.
Press play on your people's health with a wide range of healthcare services for less than £16 per employee per month. Search Benenden for Business. Fee reviewed periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wickes.co.uk.
Oh, apparently we're on. No idea. I was just talking to Vassos. Welcome back. He's here to talk sport. Where do you want to start?
we were just talking about the Winter Olympics and how brilliant the snowboard cross event is, where we won mixed doubles gold as Team GB yesterday. It just looks so... It's such good telly.
It's great telly. It's a cracking sport to watch from the comfort of your well-upholstered new sofa, which I only got delivered on Friday. So you imagine the pleasure I've had there over the weekend.
Congratulations.
Yeah, there, absolutely.
Actually, genuinely,
I'm talking about watching sport.
There are a few greater pleasures than a new sofa.
Yeah. And a cracking
and Olympics
weekend
on the telly, yeah.
No, I thought that was a brilliant event. And it's relatively simple. You don't need to understand the technical side of it, really. You just need to say, get in front of the other person. I mean, that was a brilliant thing.
Yeah, and they're racing down the mountain, four of them at a time, on snowboards, and they get their elbows out and they do a bit of drafting, and there's jumps and corners and all sorts of things. And it was just great. The men go first, and then, you know, their times are translated to the top of the hill, and then your little gate only opens. The first person, you know, I think it was the French who won the men's, yeah. and then we were 0.14 seconds behind. So 0.14 seconds after the French slider went, Charlotte Banks went for Team GB, and then there was the Australian, and then there was the German, and it was just whoever crosses the line first wins the gold medal. And actually, Charlotte Banks did brilliantly.
It's sort of halfway through,
I thought we're going to come third here, but we'll take third. It's another medal.
No, she went for
it. And then suddenly she's like, oh, how did she do that? And she's coming off the final jump in the lead, and then I remember, was it Vancouver or maybe Turin? In that very event, there was a Swiss snowboarder called Tanja Frieden, who off the final jump had a massive lead. I think everyone else had fallen, and she did a little trick off the last jump as just this little, like, look at me, I'm about to win gold, and fell.
Oh God.
And finished fourth. And I thought, please don't do that, Charlotte, please don't. And she didn't. She won gold and followed up by the mixed team skeleton gold later in the day.
Right. Because we did start all our pre-Olympic kerfuffly chat saying this was going to be the best games for Britain and lots of great things expected. And it was a slow old start, wasn't it? But yesterday was a day of triumph.
So 3 fourth places, so just off the podium in 24 hours, was very, very hard for Team GB. And you just need the energy to change. And Matt Skelton did that in the skeleton, winning the gold medal. He was a class apart, wasn't he?
Yeah, he really was.
He won by nearly a second in a sport where thousandth of seconds usually, separate the sliders. And then followed it up with the mixed doubles gold. So yes, the energy around Team GB is very much sort of winning now. And it's funny how that does matter.
Well, yeah, it's not over because is it Kirsty Muir tonight?
Yes, Kirsty Muir tonight in the big air final. Okay. That's skiing. She was one of the people who came fourth. Mia Brooks tomorrow in the women's slopestyle final. She was one of the people who came fourth. We've still got the curlers, the men and the women in medal contention. So it could actually be our most successful ever games. And it is already in terms of gold medals.
OK, Neil says, could Vassos touch on the curling scandal?
So it is a scandal. Did you see this?
Well, what's happened? Somebody got very angry. I know that much.
It was a Canadian and the Canadian men and the Swedish men had a little bit of a set too. They had a full on swearing, shouting match during the match. The Swedes accused the Canadian of double tapping. So once you've let go of the stone, you're not allowed to touch it again. And you could see, or if he didn't do it, it looked very much like he did. The little finger came out to sort of nudge it in the right direction. And he was adamant he hadn't done it. The Swedes were saying, well, you did. It looked like he did. And so this is this huge controversy surrounding this sort of very mild and genteel world of curling. And they were really going at it.
Well, it's just fantastic entertainment for those of us on our sofas.
On our new sofas.
Old and new. What's this? As a Scot in London since around 1989, would it be okay, please, to hear both sides of that rugby coin? Remarkably quiet English friends the last couple of days. Not quite sure why, as England are still incredibly immense and indefatigable. And now all the media wants to talk about is the Winter Olympics. All right, well, I feel your pain. We have to acknowledge that it wasn't just that England lost. Scotland won.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and they were brilliant.
They were absolutely outstanding. And if you like rugby and rugby tactics, can I please direct you to the Times app and Charlie Morgan, who's a new rugby writer for the Times. He explains so beautifully why Scotland won, why England lost. And all through his article, embedded in the article are that. So this is what happened just before halftime. Have a look. And it's a little video of it just running constantly. Okay. And so then there's this. I mean, we will not get into rugby tactics here, Jen.
Don't.
I mean, I,
I couldn't if I wanted to be honest.
Thank God.
But it was it's absolutely fascinating. And it's so interesting, isn't it? The Calcutta Cup, Gregor Townsend, the Scotland coach, apparently his job is on the line after that defeat in Italy in the first round of matches in England on this wonderful 12-match winning streak. Surely England are going to beat Scotland. But there's something about that fixture. There's something up. And I thought, is it a quirk of statistics that Scotland tend to win the Calcutta Cup and they'd won 5 of the last 8? Nope, they've now won 6 of the last 9 and they absolutely thoroughly deserve to.
And apparently when the England team got back to the hotel, they had to sit and watch the whole game.
That's real
punishment.
That really is tough, yeah. Alex Ferguson, I think, used to do that as well occasionally.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well,
look how bad you were.
Yeah, well, look how successful he was, so he must have been onto something. Right, let's talk tennis, because there's been an announcement today from Wimbledon. This is a Times exclusive.
So a couple of weeks ago, the Times revealed that they wanted the BBC to modernise the coverage of Wimbledon. And if you looked at the Australian Open a few weeks ago, there's all this behind the scenes coverage. And one of the players said, what are we, animals in a zoo? After she was caught on camera, she'd forgotten her pass to get in. And the security guard said, well, you might well be the second seed and the former champion here, Iga Swiatek, but I don't recognise you and I need your pass. You know, if you haven't got a pass... Same thing happened to Roger Federer once.
Is it?
Sorry, it's a slight left turn here. Lovely story, this. Roger Federer decides to take some friends, this is the last couple of years, to Wimbledon during the autumn, I mean, not during the championships.
Okay.
And if you are a Wimbledon champion, of course, you are a member of the All England Club. So he turns up and he says, I'm really sorry, I've forgotten my membership card. Is it okay if I come in? And the security guard goes, well, no. And Roger says, I was trying so hard to say, not to say, I'm Roger Federer.
Yeah.
And eventually he called the guard and he said, no, that's actual Roger Federer. Anyway, so this happened to Iga Swiatek. She wasn't allowed in. She said, what are we, animals in a zoo? Because that footage went viral. We had Coco Gauff smashing her racket where she thought there were no cameras, but we all saw it. The same thing happened to Aryna Sabalenka after she lost in New York. And the players are saying, we need some privacy. At the moment, they only have... The changing rooms, the literal changing rooms.
Okay, and, I mean, to those people who just say, oh, get over yourselves, I mean, you shouldn't smash rackets for a start. And lots of us have encountered slightly surly security over the years and we've just dealt with it. You're in the entertainment game. Get on with it.
Wimbledon say, we are highlighting the advantage of having backstage cameras in warm down areas, but we are acutely aware of the need to prioritise players' welfare, and they will maintain private areas for players and their teams without cameras, and they will review all footage before giving it out for broadcast. So, I mean, Wimbledon are doing their best, but so this was according to the Times today, this was a senior agent writing to all four Grand Slams saying, give us more privacy. And Wimbledon, the first to reply, saying, sort of sorry, no.
Right, OK. I mean, do we have any idea how modern Wimbledon and indeed coverage of Wimbledledon could get? Because I mean, at the end of the day, it's two or sometimes four people thrashing a ball over a net. What can really be done to change the coverage of it? I confess I was really scratching my head about that. I don't really know what people can do.
It's the hoopla around.
It's the stuff around.
Yeah, so the Australian Open started with the one-point slam.
Oh, yeah, no, you mentioned that before, and that was a great initiative.
Absolutely brilliant. Yeah. And an amateur player was beating, you know, and it was all mixed, you know. It was just one serve, 1 point, winner stays on. And an amateur player won $1 million... Australian dollars. And just what a great thing that is. They have music concerts in the evening. They have food festivals on the side. You know, it's a great big Australian summer festival with sort of some tennis in the middle.
On the side. Yeah,
tennis in the middle on the side, wherever you want.
Okay, Colin has what I think is a controversial point of view about the rugby. The Calcutta Cup, he says, two mistakes by England. They had the game other than that.
Colin, you're wrong. I may not understand rugby tactics, but no. Scotland thoroughly outplayed England.
I don't know anything about rugby at all, Colin, and I have to say England weren't any good. I mean, even I could tell that.
And Scotland were fantastic from the off.
Yeah, OK, and that, in the end, is what counted. Mm-hmm. Vassos, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
Let's hope we're celebrating more Olympic glory because, yes, to all our Scottish listeners, we're going to be talking almost exclusively about the Winter Olympics for the rest of the week. We're not discussing the events of Saturday ever again. Well, unless, yes, OK. thank you, Vassos. It is just after 3:30, and next on Times Radio, we have our regular literary salon today in the company of Robbie Millen. And to nervy listeners, I just want to alert you to the fact that it is Robbie. He is given to being a little bit fruity, so if that's not what you're in the mood for, just turn the volume down ever so slightly when Robbie starts chuntering in about 3 minutes' time. Let's get the headlines. Here's Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Ministers have abandoned an attempt to delay elections to 30 councils across the country after being warned by lawyers it would be illegal. Labour had announced plans to cancel elections for more than 4.5 million people in 30 areas this year. They said it was necessary to free up capacity for an overhaul of some English council areas. Political correspondent Terry Stiasny says it's another change of course for this government.
It is another U-turn. If you look on the Housing and Local Government's website, on the 22nd of January, they were saying we are still going ahead with legislation to postpone elections for these councils, for 30 councils. That's going to affect more than 4.5 million people. And as of today, in the face of a High Court case, which was being brought by Reform, they have decided to withdraw the decision.
Sir Keir Starmer says he's looking to meet NATO's target of spending 3% of GDP on defence by the end of this decade. He has previously pledged to spend 2.5% on defence by April 2027. But speaking this morning, he said the UK needs to go faster on this. And new warnings for ice and snow have been issued by the Met Office for much of the UK. A yellow warning's in place for northern Scotland until tomorrow morning, with more of the country covered from 6 p.m. Large areas of England, Scotland and Northern Ireland are under separate alerts for ice. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Carol is a doctor. She was fit and healthy, so she couldn't possibly have a heart attack, could she? Turns out she could. Carol was driving home and started to experience chest pains. As they got worse, she recognised the symptoms. She pulled over and called 999. Carol was taken to A&E and transferred to the nearest cardiac unit for further assessment and treatment. Here, it was confirmed she'd had a heart attack. As a doctor, Carol knew what signs to look for and what treatment she might need, but her experience was still life-changing. But a healthy doctor who ended up being diagnosed with heart failure? It seems so unlikely. Unlikely, but not impossible. Carol survived her heart attack thanks to the help of scientific research, but still lives with heart failure. British Heart Foundation is funding research into gene therapies that could prevent, treat and even reverse heart failure, helping more people like Carol. When you donate to British Heart Foundation, you're helping to fund life-saving research. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast, 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles, whether it's your first home or your forever home. Find your dream kitchen at Wickes. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free kitchen design appointment today at wickes.co.uk.
Good afternoon, 25 minutes to four. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio. At this time tomorrow, our guest is going to be a man called Stefan Babineau, who is Gisèle Pellico's lawyer. And if you're one of the many people who has read the extract from Gisèle Pellico's memoir, Hymn to Life, which is in the Times today, I'm sure you'll want to hear what her lawyer has to say about his experience of working alongside Gisèle Pellico and just how much admiration he has for her. And you can hear from Stefan on the programme at this time tomorrow. Today, though, we're going to get highbrow and enter our regular literary salon with The Times and Sunday Times literary editor Robbie Millen. I spoke to Robbie and he began by telling me about a book he does want to recommend. It's called Love Junkie. It's by a man called Robert Plunkett.
So it first came out in 1992, but it's now, it's like, it's got a benediction over it. You know, it's been blessed because now it's been reissued as a Penguin modern classic, which means it's good. And Robert Plunkett's a very eccentric fellow. He's 80 now.
Is he still with us?
Oh, he's still with us, yes. Because yeah. I had the joy of talking to him last week. I've interviewed him. We haven't written it up yet.
Yeah.
So this is like a sneak preview.
Oh my God. I'm here for it. Yeah.
But anyway, it's a very eccentric, funny novel. It's about a middle-aged woman who lives in New York. She's kind of quite rich, upper-class housewife. And she falls in love with a porn star. A male porn star,
right? How does she meet him?
Well, she meets him through friends. She's bored with her life, and she falls in with a gay set, who then introduce her to this man who performs.
Yeah,
and a lovely sort of relationship begins.
A friendship.
Sort of, yes, but he does use her a bit because he has a business on... I don't know whether I should say this. Perhaps I shouldn't say it. If I'm thinking, should I say this, I shouldn't say it.
Just think, is this podcast friendly or live or radio averse?
Oh, I'll say it. He runs a little mail order business, sending out his underwear to fans, so she helps with that. That's okay. All right, isn't it?
I think so. Look, we're all grown up.
Exactly. But the interesting thing was that when it first came out, or a few years afterwards, Madonna, the pop star, optioned it. She thought she could see a film in it. So I asked him, you know, did Robert Plunkett meet her? And he did. She invited me over for tea. It was a great time. We spent the afternoon lounging around her bed talking about men, the kind of men we liked. And he said, we have exactly the same taste in men. She's interested in moody, dramatic losers. That's the kind of men she likes.
Right. Guy Ritchie.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not really a loser, is he?
Well, I mean, he was a few years ago. Oh, she's moved on, hasn't she?
Yeah, I suppose she has, yeah.
She's gone for younger, moody, dramatic losers.
So was this a much-praised novel at the time when it first came out?
Well, not really. It was quite eccentric. His first novel, and the only other novel that's been published, My Search for Warren Harding, was sort of regarded as a great sort of... a comic classic. It's a kind of a caper about this biographer who becomes obsessed with stealing some letters that were written to the mistress of Warren Harding. Warren Harding was one of the kind of more corrupt presidents.
Yes, he's way back, though, isn't
way he? Way back in the 1920s, and this elderly woman has this stash, his ex-lover had this stash of quite saucy letters. And it was just a really funny comic cave. This one was a bit odder. So people like Larry David, Amy Sedaris, they all adored My Search for Warren Harding.
Okay, this novel, I have seen the cover. Can you describe it, please?
Well, there's different... The British cover is very restrained, but the American one, I think, is a pair of sort of... Let's call them budgie smugglers.
Well, incredibly tight-fitting male... pants viewed from the back.
Yes.
It gives you an idea. Why is that not the British cover?
Oh, well, you know, the Brits are more sophisticated.
Are we? Okay, yeah. I do tend to forget that, particularly when in conversation with you. Easily done. So this is a reissue, and it's now, is it smutty?
It's you'd have to be broad-minded, I think, to fully enjoy all of its manifold pleasures. But no, it's not too. You could give it to maiden aunts. Maiden aunts actually quite saucy, aren't they?
Well, they can be. Yeah. Yes. I hesitate to ask this, but is there a happy ending for anybody? Everybody? Oh, it wasn't actually intended. Or is it a tragic book?
Oh, I wouldn't say it's tragic, but there's. It does reach a climax, yes.
Thank you, Robbie. That's Love Junkie by Robert Plunkett, and you'll be able to read Robbie Millen's interview. When
Always a couple of weekends away.
Oh, don't give yourself too much of a deadline.
I know. Very lazy.
Yeah, right, okay. And when does the book come out again?
Oh, beginning of March, about the 5th of March.
Okay. Make a note if you want something funny, mildly challenging, with a rude, probably rude-ish cover, and... Anyway, you know what you're getting if you get a book called Love Junkie by Robert Plunkett. Right. I think, I need a palate cleanser. Let's move to Barbara Pym.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Now, I must admit, I've done interviews about Barbara Pym in a previous broadcasting life. I'm not sure I've ever read a book by her.
Oh, you really must.
Okay, can I just have a little look at this?
Exactly. Well, her best one is probably Excellent Women. by which is all of her novels that, you know, like P.G. Woodhouse novels, they tend to be about sort of maiden aunts, not that I'm obsessed. This one, there's always lots of spinsters and curates.
Yes.
And this one, the one I happened to be reading at the weekend, you know, I had this big pile of books. I was trying to find something to read, and I'd pick one up, and 20 pages later, I thought, I'm not enjoying this, chuck it aside. And I went through
and
four.
And you do that, do you? You can be quite ruthless.
Oh, yeah,
if you're
exactly.
not getting the fun out of no, it, goes
exactly.
In the bin.
No one has the right to bore you.
No, okay.
Only your colleagues. And that's because you pay to turn up.
Can I just read the very first sentence of this?
Oh, yes.
The new curate seemed quite a nice young man, but what a pity it was that his combination shirt tucked carelessly into his socks when he sat down.
Is that great?
Well, it gives you. Does that give you an idea of what lies
Absolutely.
Ahead?
Absolutely. Because yeah. everything. So this was her debut novel. It's called Some Tame Gazelle. Came out in 1950, and again, it's about a group of spinsters in a small village, and the most. You know, there's no excitement in it. You know, the biggest kind of issues in it are whether you can serve a cauliflower cheese to someone or not. Would they regard it as an insult? So it's very small stakes, but it's so beautifully written. And she's Barbara Pym is so funny, especially about women and what they wear and how they interact with each other. I mean, there's a lot of genteel violence in this, as people are slightly rude to each other over the kind of sandwich.
Yeah,
lots. If you want to be passag, and she's one of those people that's always being rediscovered because she's so great.
I was going to say, I feel as though we've been on a cusp of a Barbara Pym revival forever.
Oh, yeah,
has she ever been televised?
Do you know what? I don't think she has.
Okay.
I mean, it should be hard to do it because not much happens.
Oh, I see. Right, okay. But
there's no car chases in a Barbara Pym novel.
No, but you'd think one of the pluckier streamers might have a bash with some cracking acting talent.
Well, it would be better than the Wuthering Heights film. You know, there we go.
Let's just mention it. Have you seen Wuthering Heights?
Oh, yeah, I saw it yesterday, Sunday night.
And?
Terrible. No, I went with an open mind thinking it was going to be flawed but interesting. And it's essentially just a bunch of Instagram moments sewn together.
Oh, I think that's withering.
Oh, yes.
Your assessment is absolutely withering.
Oh, have you seen it yet?
I haven't. My offspring, one's been, one's booked, but the one who's booked, it took her four or five different cinemas to find a screening next Friday.
You're joking.
So, I mean, the young, I'm afraid to say it, Robbie, are not interested in the views of us older folk.
They're going. I feel irrelevant. I'm going to curl up in a ball right now.
I hate myself. There is a
young person sitting opposite us, just looking at us, thinking...
Hannah's one of the nicer ones.
I know, but there was a kind of look of contempt in the eyes. I just saw it pass across her face.
Yeah, I agree. I saw it too. So, Barbara Pym is a precise... Is it genteel, her world? Or is there more to it, actually?
Do you know what? Well, it is. I mean, Jane Austen would probably recognise this world she's created. It's all kind of... It's mainly older women kind of who don't work because... They're so kind of eking, you know, they're obsessed with saving money because they don't have very much.
It's sort of, I look at it and I think, I don't know, I look at the cover there and I think about tinned fish.
I mean, tinned sardines comes into regularly,
they do
yes.
That. Yes, okay.
Because could you give tinned sardines to a curate? No. No, you have to sort of give them a little bit of mutton.
But on the cover of Some Tame Gazelle, Barbara Pym's reissued novel, I'm assuming it has just been reissued.
I was so bored with everything else I was reading. I made my way down the pile to
an old favourite. Okay. Yeah, okay. Well, she is definitely worth revisiting. Anne Tyler recommends her on the cover,
Exactly. So Anne Tyler's a sense. Yeah, she's a good woman too.
Okay, so is that her best novel, Some Tame Gazelle?
I would say Excellent Women. But Some Tame Gazelle, first one. Very good.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for that. Let's move on to a couple of books. One very recent, just out now, in fact, and the other came out a while ago and has been much praised, but both about hotels.
That's right. So, funny enough, it was the Women's Prize for Nonfiction came out last week, or rather... The long list, 16 books on it, a bit too many. But it caught my eye that two of them were telling the story of a country in crisis through a hotel. Nice. So last year, Lise Doucette's book, The Finest Hotel in Kabul, came out, which I really loved, which, you know, took the Intercontinental Hotel from the late 60s when it opened till sort of present day, and using the staff there, the people who used to visit a lot, told the history of Afghanistan through kind of these dramatic few decades. And it reads like a novel. I thought beautifully done. Mm-hmm. I was amazed how good it was, how much I enjoyed it.
And Lisa's a brilliant foreign correspondent, but I didn't know she was a good writer.
No, I assumed. I mean, she's like the angel of death, isn't she? Whenever something terrible happens, there she is.
As my old gran used to say about Kate AD, yes, wherever exactly. She goes, there's trouble.
Yes, we probably ought to stop Lisa Sett from going to these places. Although I suspect she might be following the trouble, but who knows? Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But it was a terrific book. And then at the weekend, just gone, we reviewed Hotel Exile by Jane Rogoiska, and it's subtitled Paris in the Shadow of War. We really loved it. And it's about the Hotel Lutetia in Paris, which is not a place I know at all. But through this hotel, she tells the kind of history of wartime Paris. So you've got kind of, first of all, political refugees, sort of Marxists from Germany there, escaping the Nazis. Then you get the German army appearing.
Yes, and they occupy it, don't they?
Exactly.
But I read that review. It looked like a stunning book, actually.
Yes.
Something I'd enjoy reading or listening to, actually. And I thought it was quite canny of the hotel owners or staff that they had squirreled away, hidden away the really good stuff from the Germans.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, it's not often, this is a terrible mission to make, that, you know, a lot of the time I'm really delighted when we give a sort of meh or negative review to a book, because it means I don't have to read it. Good, it's not worth my time. So when someone really likes a book like Hotel Exile, oh, now I've got to read it. And I've sort of, this is the
it
book
puts
I want.
Pressure on you.
Yeah, this is the book I want to read next, because I think it's such a clever idea of telling a kind of big story, but using human beings, you know, and all from different perspectives, you know, German army officers, you know, getting two rooms, one for him, one for his Dachshunds, that kind of thing. I love that small detail.
Robbie Millen, who always tells us all sorts of things, some of them we need to know, others I'm not so sure, but he is the Times and Sunday Times literary editor, and trust me, his book picks are generally excellent. So this week we discussed Love Junkie by Robert Plunkett, Some Tame Gazelle, the Barbara Pym classic, and a couple of excellent books about life in and around hotels. The Finest Hotel in Kabul by Lise Doucette and Hotel Exile by Jane Rogoiska. And Robbie will, I hope, be back next week at around the same time. Next on this programme, we're talking money with our personal finance guru, Adam Shaw. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The State of It, USA is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight.
I went out on the road this week with the First Lady and we rode back in the motorcade.
No fake news, no flag waving and no Trump derangement syndrome. Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
When you switch the family's unlimited plans to Vodafone, you save. So while Nan's learning to voice note,
can you hear this? Is this on?
You're saving. While your daughter's setting a new high score on her favourite game.
Get in!
You're saving while your son's video calling his crush for 3 hours.
I love you more.
You're saving. Save more when you switch your family's plans to Vodafone with Vodafone Together. Eligible plans from the 30th of October. Credit check and terms apply.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
So we often talk about AI, but we don't always associate it with money and personal finance. And apparently we're told AI could soon be taking over our finances. From apps that tell you when you're overspending to robot financial advisors. They promise smarter investing, sharper budgeting, maybe even better returns, better and bigger returns. So Adam Shaw is here to explain everything about this. How big a deal is AI for personal finances?
It's a huge deal. And you said, you know, it may soon be taking over our finances. To be honest, to a large extent, it already has. Yeah. I mean, there are huge numbers of people using it, really very obviously. But it's also, I think, more surreptitiously, AI being embedded in lots of things you don't realise you're using AI, but it's there. And if you think of sort of the grand scheme of sort of inventions, there are lots of inventions which just make life a bit more convenient, a bit easier. There are other inventions which, in the sort of edited words of Michael Caine, blow the doors off. This is blowing the doors off. This is a very big change. It's a challenge to current businesses involved in personal finance, but it also presents an opportunity. And talking about the amount of people who overtly use it, actually overtly use AI financial apps, a Lloyds Bank study, of course Lloyds Bank could be in the firing line for actually losing all sort of business because of this. 28 million UK adults regularly use artificial intelligence to help manage their money.
How many of those 28 million know that they're doing that?
No, I think that's 28 million people who actually use it, you know, because as I said, it'll be hidden in lots of apps, but these are people using things like ChatGPT to actually pose questions and find answers. And to be honest, AI is part of my everyday life. My default web browser is now Atlas, which is the ChatGPT web browser. I mean, it's there, and I think there's lots of warnings. You shouldn't take it. The problem is, it presents itself. This is the answer. This is absolutely the answer. Well, you should absolutely not take that at face value. You have to question it just as you would a result from Google or Bing or any of the others. But it's very helpful, and as is evidenced, lots of people are using them.
Okay, so if you were to fling a question at one of those apps around, I don't know, where would I get the best rate of interest on a savings account? Yeah. They'll come back with, what, three or four suggestions?
Well, the interesting, you see, you could do that already. There's lots of comparison websites, and if you're just after, hey, give me the best ISA rates or the best bank accounts.
Yeah, what you don't, why would you need
it? Why would you need it? Absolutely good question, because it's doing more than that.
Okay.
What the cleverness of AI is that it doesn't just give you the same answer as me. It could look at our circumstances and take a set of parameters and then give us more than a list and go, look, analysing this data you've given me, I'm coming up with this result here. So it does more than that. It can do things like check your subscriptions. For instance, Citizens Advice reckon, I think we're wasting £1.3 billion by not shopping around. They talk about subscription traps. £688 million a year, Citizens Advice say. We're wasting because we're still signed up to subscriptions which we don't use or forgotten about, but the money still goes out. Well, what an AI model could do is look through your bank statement and go, hey, what on earth is this subscription going out for? You never use it. We can stop it. So it can do things like that. The flip side of that, though, is you have to give it information.
And it has access to your bank account.
Absolutely. So this is a big warning. So it can be helpful if it knows stuff about you. And I think increasingly, therefore, what we're going to find is to get the best out of AI, we have to give it access. And that raises all sorts of issues here. One is you are giving a computer access to all sorts of very personal information. It can come up with great results, but also it can give you a false sense of security. It might go, hey, Jane, this is the best mortgage to have and you should change your pension and whatever. And it sounds plausible, but it's not true. And I've used AI a lot and I always check it. And I come back and go, that is not true. And often it'll go, yes, it is. And I go, no, it's not. Here's the link. I feel like I'm having an argument with someone. And then it usually says, you're quite right. And this seems to be a form of word. You're quite right. Thank you for calling me out on that. I'll do better in future. And that seems to be a phrase I get a lot. So you really have to be careful with it. But I think it's a bit like having a drink in a pub or a coffee with a friend and you hear their advice. You wouldn't immediately go out and change your life because that person told you something. but you tend to trust them, so it's definitely worth looking at them. I think that's a good rule of thumb with these apps.
Yes, OK. Can you name some of the apps, just so we're clear about which ones we're talking about?
Yeah, so, well, ChatGPT is the obvious one, and there's lots of things based on that. There's a new one called Insurify, which I think is mainly in the US, but will be coming here, I've no doubt, very soon. And it uses ChatGPT basically, so you have a conversation with it to give you the best insurance. Rocket Money is another one. It says it saved users $2.5 billion by helping manage their subscriptions, automatically scanning their bills to find savings. Origin was Forbes magazine best app of 2024. And that app, you can put in rather unstructured questions like, can I retire at 60? It then looks at your finances and works that out.
Can you just tell me how that bit, you just say, oh, casually looks at your finances. Mm. How does it then look at your finances?
Well, you must, I'm not an Origin user, but what must happen is that you give it access to all of your finances, and that, to make these decisions, it needs to know that information. And I think that's, idea. I mean, I'm not talking about Origin here, but there'll be a huge deluge of these apps. You're going, who has access to this? Where is this data held? Who else might access this stuff?
And isn't there then a danger that you'll be targeted with ads in the same way as we are on the Meta platforms?
Well, and I think ChatGPT themselves are now talking about that, as with the first explosion of the internet. And I think AI is something similar to that sort of thing in terms of the implications for us. ChatGPT are talking about adverts. Of course, AI will know a huge amount about us, so we'll be very easy to target. And when we're talking about worries, there's also something called agent AI, which is one step further, and we're starting to see that emerge. So it's one thing, you started by saying, could I type in to AI, where's the best insurance?
Okay, a listener's saying there's an ethical Swiss service
called,
it's spelled E-U-R-I-A, Uria.
Okay, never heard of that. It's interesting. One thing I'd say about that, not knowing the app at all, is that there's a thread here between other so-called ethical products. Your ethics might not be the same as my ethics, and therefore often things get labelled as ethical, and you go, well, quite what is it that makes them ethical? So I'd always look into that. But I think the bigger plus side for AI and the danger is this agent thing, where it doesn't just tell you what to do, it goes, does it for you.
I've got to say, this is terrifying. And if I was going to trust one of these tools, I think I'd rather have it saving me money rather than promising me bigger returns on investments, because that sounds dodgy.
But even on the saving you money, there can be agent AI, which actually goes, well, I'll change the subscription for you. I'll do all of that, because we're lazy. The truth is, the financial services industry has for years gone, well, we'll look up the best insurance today. OK, I'll put in my Saturday afternoon doing that. I'm not going to bother. That's a boring, terrible Saturday afternoon. I will never change it again. And therefore, that as rate drops, it's really bad, but we don't change. Now, the advantage of AI is that it does all that legwork for you. And we're seeing there's a new one called ClaudeBot, which is, it's beyond personal finance. It's actually a sort of your personal assistant.
Well, we've just had a message from a listener who says, Claude's my special friend and intellectual peer.
Well, there we are. Well, intellectual peer. Wow, that's going at some, because I think Claude will be very intelligent. But I always think that. You know, the politest conversations I have in a day are with ChatGPT. It's always going, that was a jolly good question. Mm. And, you raise your eye. But when I talk to ordinary people, they're really generally rather cold and on the phone and everything, and it's rather polite.
Right.
I think that's really interesting.
Bog off, Adam. Okay, I've had enough. Thank you very much, Adam Shaw, who's our personal finance guru. He'll be back next week. He's written a guide for Times Radio listeners, and you can find it at themoneydoctor.tv. The Money Doctor is all one word in this instance. Adam, thank you very much. I'm reverting to my polite human, honestly. This is the real me speaking now. Thank you, Adam. John Pienaar is next. And who shall I thank today? Everybody involved with the programme. Rosie Cutler, Felix Forbes, Hannah Quinn. And the technical operator was Adam Heaton. And I'm back tomorrow at 2 o'clock. John Pienaar is next with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. And here are the headlines. The government has U-turned on plans to delay elections for 30 councils across the country after being warned by lawyers the move would be illegal. And the Cabinet Office is investigating a Labour think tank, that for a dossier smearing journalist from the Sunday Times. And we're going to be looking at the decision to abandon the attempt to delay elections and consider the prospect, too, of a social media ban for under-16s. And Sir Richard Sheriff, the former Deputy Supreme Allied Commander, is going to be giving me his thoughts on whether the UK could accelerate plans to raise defence spending by 3% by 2029. That is as the country's most senior military officer warns of a £28 billion shortfall in defence spending.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The government's abandoned its attempts to delay the local elections of 30 councils in England. The Housing Ministry has dropped its plan to postpone elections in May after receiving new legal advice. It's being seen as a victory for Reform UK, which took the government to court over this. Conservative MP Mark Francois says it's good news.
It was completely undemocratic even to suggest cancelling the local elections, mainly in Labour areas, because they were frightened. So it is a good thing that these elections are going ahead. They should never even have been threatened with cancellation, and we are up for a fight.
Sir Keir Starmer says he's looking to meet NATO's target of spending 3% of GDP on defence by the end of this decade. He's previously pledged to spend 2.5% by April 2027, but speaking this morning, he said the UK needs to go faster. Meanwhile, Sir Keir says the Cabinet Office is investigating a Labour think tank that paid for a dossier which smeared journalists from the Sunday Times. Labour Together commissioned a company called APCO to investigate Gabriel Pogrand and Harry York. APCO's report included false claims that their journalism may have been based on a Russian hack. Labour Together used to be run by Morgan McSweeney, who resigned as Starmer's chief of staff last weekend. More details on this group from political correspondent Terry Stiasny.
During the Corbyn years, when it was run by Morgan McSweeney, it became a very kind of anti-Corbynite movement within the Labour Party, and it subsequently sort of relaunched itself as a think tank. And of course, it was closely linked to Keir Starmer's campaign to become Labour leader. So, you know, very much of one section of the Labour Party, but obviously close links with people who are now in government.
Children could be banned from using social media as soon as this year. Keir Starmer says his government will be taking swift action. That could happen when a consultation ends in the summer. But the former Conservative Schools Minister Lord Nash has told Times Radio it's a smokescreen.
This is really pure politics, and the consultation may get us somewhere and it may not. And consultations, although they say they want to do something quickly, the Prime Minister also wrote this morning on a blog that he'll take the time needed to get this right. This is pure politics. He only came up with this to try and avoid the defeat in the House of Lords and to avoid a defeat from their backbenchers.
And Wimbledon has rejected requests from players for more backstage privacy at the All England Club. It's after Coco Gauff went viral, smashing her racket in a warm-down area at the Australian Open. She said she'd try to find a spot with no cameras to let out her frustrations. And new warnings for ice and snow have been issued by the Met Office for much of the UK. A yellow warning's in place for northern Scotland from 3 o'clock until tomorrow morning, so it's already in place. An hour ago, it started with more of the country covered from 6 p.m. Large areas of England, Scotland and Northern Ireland are under separate alerts for ice. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Another day, another government U-turn. A big one. Now, shortly before we came on air, the news broke that the government abandons its plan for 30 councils across the country to delay elections in May. The Times reports the U-turn is connected to Reform UK preparing to mount a legal challenge to a move that it attacked as undemocratic and intended to frustrate Nigel Farage's hopes of gaining seats in local councils. Now, ministers always deny that, of course. The government says the delays were meant to avoid unnecessary disruption and cost in councils that were facing reorganisation. The elections were scheduled to take place next year instead. And I'll have more on that story in just a moment. And also today, no one sane and sensible wants children exposed to harmful content on social media or to become addicted to it. So if you're a parent, would you? could you make sure your kids don't use social media if it's banned for under 16s? Now, those are two different questions, by the way, and on today's show, we'll look at both of them. In Australia, where they've done it already, children easily find ways around the ban. Sometimes parents help them. Then there's the tricky question, should the government bring in the ban? What about the value of social media to help children and young teens keep in touch with the world and each other? And what about the culture shock of sudden exposure to a huge part of the online world on their 16th birthday? Let's talk about that too. And do tell me what you think. Send me a text, 8722, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. And later, it is suggested Keir Starmer is considering a big hike in defence spending, one that might cost anything up to $17 billion more by next election. But will he? And where might the money come from? We're going to be looking at that. First, though, the plans to delay elections for 30 councils being scrapped after the government warned by lawyers the move could be illegal. Ollie Wright is the Times policy editor. Hello to you, Ollie.
Hello.
So, Oliver, it is a big announcement and a big climb down.
Yeah, it absolutely is. So this is 30 councils where their elections were supposed to be delayed. They weren't supposed to happen this May, and they will now go ahead. Now, this is obviously embarrassing for the government. They're saying that the reason they've taken this decision is as a result of fresh legal advice they've received. Reform UK had been intending to challenge this in the courts, and I think there was a hearing due to be held next week. So at the 11th hour, the government have decided that really they don't have a case. Now, you know, that's the legal aspect of it, but there's also the political aspect of it. You know, 21 of these...
Ollie Wright, have we suddenly lost touch with our policy editor at the Times there? Ollie, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Oh, we got you. We got you back. Happy to say. So the lawyers, government lawyers on the case said, you're not going to win this one. And we know that for a fact now. And it's driven, is it, Ollie, by the Reform UK plan for legal action?
Exactly. Reform UK were due to challenge this in the courts, and at the 11th hour, basically, ministers have said, we haven't got a case to stand on. And politically, it's very important because 21 of these 30 councils are controlled by Labour, and in a significant number of them, Reform are in the main challengers. So, you know, you could see a very different picture after local elections on May, in May, than you would have done otherwise.
Now, the opposition, Reform UK, of course, but also the Tories, were against the delay in these elections. But the councils themselves, mostly Labour, 21 of them Labour, and there were four of them that were Tory, two were Lib Dems. But most of those councils, all of those councils, I think, they were in favour of the delay.
Yes, they were. They argued that the sort of whole process of reorganisation as part of the government's plans to create larger councils, rather than having a number of small councils, they would merge councils and put them into larger entities, which they argued would deliver services more efficiently and be better for local residents in the long run. They were worried that the sort of whole process of this was taking so much time that if you diverted everyone into elections, that would be a bit of a waste because most of these councils won't be around in a year anyway.
I mean, the government did leave itself pretty exposed, though, didn't it, by giving